Greetings, pals. It's me, Duncan Trussell. I am recording this in the gym. I've been training some of my clients nonstop, getting people ripped, greased, slicked down, beard trims. I do that sometimes for my clients, lots of things for my clients, things that we can talk about if you reach out to me. That right now, just because of the sex negative world that we live in, I can't actually mention it online without breaking many, many laws. But to me, working out is more than just lifting those weights. It's more than just getting your yoga pants on. It's a holistic experience of health. And when I work out, I'll tell you a story. Here's the deal. Once I had a great workout. Not my best, pretty good. It was leg day, and I gassed out on my glutes and had to just stop. It was embarrassing. And I was headed towards the locker room, call it a day. At least I got to the gym, you know, telling myself all that stuff. When five of these incredibly healthy women, two very powerful men, they waved at me from, I guess, an office space in the gym, you know, where they sign the contracts for the memberships. And I don't know, it was weird the way they waved at me. There was a twinkle in their eye. And so, yeah, I got banged down hard after that workout. I didn't know them. They didn't know me. I think they saw that I was a little bummed that my workout hadn't been spectacular, which is what I prefer, like A-grade level workouts. And yeah, it was quick. Wasn't really romantic. It was like very healthy. Very healthy. And somewhat painful, but in a good way. I walked out of there, took a shower, and for the rest of the day, I felt great. Now, you know, just getting banged down at the gym by strangers is awesome. But I noticed something. The next day, my glutes had more definition than they should have. And I realized there's a direct connection between getting banged down after a workout by strangers and not just glute definition, but full body tone and complexion stuff. My skin was glowing. I had an extruded nipple. Before that happened to me, one of my nipples, I don't know what had happened. I went to the doctor and he was just like, I can't help you. And I honestly, please put your shirt back on. Because one of my nipples kind of like, I don't know how to put it other than it looked like imagine if you rolled up a bunch of pepperonis into a tube and then used some kind of mallet to like bang out a sort of jagged shape. That's what one of my nipples, I woke up with it, looked like. After this bang down, nipple had receded, nipples were symmetrical, definition in my abs, definition in my glutes. So with my new training service, not only are you going to get top tier training from the YouTube videos that I will show you as you work out, but also once a month, you won't know when it's going to happen. You will get a full service bang down. Full service. You will get banged down. It will be fast. And I will be there watching. I will be there as your cheerleader. There's going to be moments where you want to like pull out or just, you know, that's enough. You're going to feel like you can't take it. But as a trainer, I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you push through those moments. And the next day, you're going to wake up with better skin, more definition, and a feeling that you are living life again, that your life was on hold, and that suddenly life, beautiful, perfect, glorious life, had come knocking at your door, and you answered this time instead of telling it to get the fuck out of here. You can reach out to me via my socials. You'll have to go through a pretty intense screening process. And then if you are selected, you can look forward to being in the best shape of your life within only a couple of years. Yeah, it's longer than what other trainers promise. But that's how you know I'm being real. I invite you this summer to take the dive into my new bang down, big glutes, Definition Day training program. Definition Day for short. It is patent pending. You can also go to definitionday.gov, fill out a form there, or you can write us. It's 795 Williams Street, Sedona, Arizona, suite 59495795 9759 9759 5159 7159 9519 5193 219-419 suite 22. I look forward to hearing from you, and I look forward to walking with you on your health journey. We have an incredible podcast for you today with one of my greatest friends. I love him so much. He's also my boss now because he is creating the show for Fox. I'm on called Crapopolis. You've heard him before on the DTFH and no doubt other places. Dan Harmon is here with us today. Let's welcome Dan Harmon back to the DTFH. Dan, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. You know what's changed between us that's really weird is you're my boss now.
Yeah, I know. I've ruined it.
It's fucking weird. You're my boss.
You never think about that. Like, you know, I should hire my friend. Like, it doesn't seem like a... You don't think about a negative part of that when you're like, you don't want to be your friend's boss.
You're my boss. I answer to you. You're like the top of the chain. You're my boss.
But it's
I like it.
Yeah, but I mean, we work creatively, so I mean, I'm not really your boss because I can't like fire you.
Well, it's not like we're at a drugstore or something.
Right.
That would
like,
fuck
I can't, we're partners because like I could, if we got pissed at each other, you'd have just as much a shot at getting me fired as anybody else and each other, you know, like we'd have to have dirt on each other and then like cancel each other. I couldn't just be
No way that I could possibly get you fired from, not that I would want that. That would be hell for everyone. But I don't think that that's true. I don't think like how would I even do that? How does
I'm trying to make it a better, I got here's what I'm saying. I don't think there's been a shift in power dynamic.
Oh, right. I mean, I don't think so.
Because it doesn't still look up to you. I don't control whether you eat, and you're no more inclined to agree with me or anything.
Right.
Like you're not going to like look the other way if I don't use a coaster at your apartment. You're still going to be the same hard ass about coasters that you've always been.
Never going to change, man. Never going to change because it's a fucked up thing to do, Dan. I know it's funny you'd bring it up now, but I don't want to get into the coaster thing. It is weird when I have like so many coasters, beautiful coasters, coasters from all over the country, coasters from everywhere I've done stand up. And yeah, you'll just put your like, there's more coasters on the table than table space.
Yeah, you got to go. Well, that's why I... In my defense, that's why I always move them aside with the bottom of my glass to find a place to put it down. Cause I feel like they're so ornamental and they're so not to judge, but they're so self-serving. Like you said, they have it's a lot of promotion of your little cottage industry.
It's got my ticket sales from each show written underneath how I did.
I think it's like, look, if you really want me to use a coaster, you should put like Gaddafi's face on it or something.
I would do that. I'll do that. I know a coaster guy. No problem. So the next time I see you, I will have a Gaddafi's face.
Because you
coaster.
Know how fucked off I still am about Libya.
Why were you so into Gaddafi? That was a question for deeper into the podcast.
Nah, I want to put a drink on his face. How many times do I have to do this rant?
No, I know. But it is weird. No, it's obsessive. I mean, it is like, I mean, no, I don't know even that much about Libya or Gaddafi. I just found out Libya was in Africa.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I thought you were saying, I thought you were extending a bit and going, why were you so obsessed about it? You said, why were we obsessed with it?
No,
I think, as a country,
it was condescension. I was saying we like you to make you more comfortable with you. It was like, I don't want to do the intervention anymore. If you're into Gaddafi, you're into Gaddafi. If you hate Gaddafi, if you are like still angry at a dead man,
I know. Well, it's like you tried to tell me back in the 70s when I first started really gunning for him.
Yeah.
When we were just 25 and 17 respectively.
Yeah.
And that's the first time you said to me, you know, Dan, the opposite of hate is not love, it's indifference. And I was like, who's this 17-year-old telling me how to feel about Gaddafi in 1972.
You know, I do not want to start shit on the podcast, but he was a good leader in a lot of ways.
He kept the trains running on time, but Hashtag so did Hitler. I'll say it. I'll use it on about everything.
Have you ever been on a Libyan train now? Have you tried to take a train in Libya recently? Do you know what a nightmare it is now? Just to like get through the turnstile.
now that the Jim Henson of Libyan mass transit is dead.
It's just
have I
fucked.
Been on the reboot of now that Gaddafi's daughter is running his trains?
When they were killing him, stabbing him, did you know all those people, they were like 3 hours late getting home? Because the trains immediately started fucking up, just as though they were connected to him or
it's
some metaphysical
karma.
Instant karma. I don't know, man. I think that one day you're just going to turn a corner. The Hare Krishnas, they say that it doesn't matter if you love Krishna or if you hate Krishna, if you have any connection to Krishna at all, there's still a spiritual holy component in it. And I feel like your hate for Gaddafi, it reminds me of that. That like it's always on the verge
of flipping.
I would say to those folks,
that sounds like Krishna is saying, that they're using the you're talking about him defense, which I don't.
Wait, now what is it they say? They say free rent in your head, bro, or something
free,
like that.
Krishna's living rent-free in your head, motherfucker. I mean, once you have to be that trollish about your God, maybe he's a bad God.
If you take it literally, like any of this stuff.
If people take Krishna literally, that's the problem. You need to, he's being sincere, but not literal. Wait, what was the thing?
I think that's the problem with these symbols. Like any of the metaphysical systems have within them a symbol set that on one level is at the very least confusing, if not completely ridiculous. But people get caught up in the physicality of that. But when you drop it into like a deeper place, suddenly it becomes like the existence of the thing as a living thing becomes irrelevant to like the just basic sort of parable aspect. It's like a little healthy riddle for your mind to gnaw on that will make you a little less of an asshole. That it's like the data set itself is what's mystical, not the right. Like, so, is there a blue skin coward boy living in a place called Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan, where he eternally plays with the gopis, his friends, and like everything, they're ascension. Like, is that a place in space, time space? I don't know, but it would be great if it were. But the idea of how obsession, even in the negative, has within it a component of passion. I think that's interesting. It is living rent free in your head. Look, I love it, man. I love your mind. I love throwing my spiritual stuff into your orbit and watching you swat it down. Just swat it like flies.
That's not. That's not my role. I was doing a bit. I'm more into Krishna than you are.
No, you know, and I think that to me, and this will probably, maybe this will sound annoying. I think that's what makes you mystical. I think you have a mystical talent in like obliterating certain spiritual ideas that I have not applied that sort of thinking towards in a way where it's like, you definitely have left me scrambling most of the time with this stuff. I'll just try to forget what you said.
Don't forget this. You're a Krishna poser, and I am way more, I've been way more into him or her. You're welcome. For way longer. Like, who was your favorite Krishna? Probably Roger Moore, because you're a fucking poser.
That was the worst Krishna.
I am old school. You're not. Sean Connery, no, you're Krishna.
Not. No, yeah. You're not. No, where's your beads?
You probably never even read the original books. You probably think that the thing that makes Krishna cool is all the gadgets.
That is 100% what makes Krishna cool. No,
that's not the original. The original Krishna didn't even get gadgets when they went on a mission. They were just a dark, like basically an assassin for Vishnu.
Look, that whole storyline, again, if you take it literally, those missions and stuff, yeah, whatever. But no, man, the Krishna's conch shell, which one has the club? He's got a spinning disc. The spinning disc is cool.
Shiva was the villain in the first one, and the whole gimmick was... But again, this is poser Krishna stuff, but it's like when they started getting sensational. But Shiva was introduced as the character that had the club that had a womb on it. She's the destroyer. So she would swing the club at you and a baby would come out. But the baby would spend a lifetime getting to your face.
Yep.
And by the time it got to your face, it was your age. And
it was you.
Yeah, and it was you. And then it died. And then you were like, you missed me. And Shiva's like, did I? I'm pretty sure I nailed you, dude. Like, and then you look down at this dead, like, meta-human on the ground that's like you going like, yeah, she got you.
But what I love the most about that is the part where when the people who had themselves flung at them and watched themselves age as they were hurtling towards them, when they're dying, the last thing they saw was them younger as they were hurtling towards them. So you didn't just witness your own collapse into old age, disease, and death in those moments when he threw the baby, but... you would also witness in your last moment, you young. That's the ultimate punishment.
Yeah.
You get a glimpse of your healthy
That's why they
you.
Called her the destroyer, man. I for sure. I just think that that's the reason why then it turned into like Shiva of the week with the Krishna franchise.
Shiva of the week? Really? Shiva of the week? You didn't like the NFTs? You didn't like that? I made a lot of money off of some of those.
I think they started listening to the fans too much. I think I'll say it. I think there's such a thing as playing to your base too much.
Okay. Well, we live in the age of social media and like allowing your base to be involved creatively. I this is another disagreement we have. Do you are you like where I where so are you where are you at in thinking about God? Like what are your thoughts on that? Like, does it ever cross your mind anymore? Or have you just written off the concept? because I know, like, one of the things I love about you is it seems like you're pretty, like, opposed to God, or you're not into that.
I think I'm just scared of God. I don't think I'm opposed to my God.
Post God, like, maybe there was a time when you felt like something or connected, or there was a sense, and now you've your mind has, like, unraveled it to the point of, like, but you're saying you're scared of God.
Yeah, but you're right. I thought you said opposed, but post is probably kind of accurate. I really have become, and I don't see this as a good thing. I'm not bragging about it, nor do I see it as I don't think this is a fait accompli. Like, I'm not pronouncing it and forgiving it and saying this is how it's going to be. But I do feel like like I'm defined by exhaustion lately. And I bet that's a really relatable thing. I think that it's like the minute we want to start talking about post-pandemic, we also are feeling already post-pandemic. Like, we're post everything. We keep going through things that we don't want to hear about anymore. And, like, it's been a weird. I would have said 5 years, but maybe we should now start saying decade. But it's like, anyways, like, I don't mean I'm in the same position that everyone else is in. I just mean, like, I don't think I'm all that unique in that all these major conversations, like people saying, like, do you believe in ghosts, or where are you at spiritually, or even like, how's your relationship going, your perfect relationship with Cody where you have no problems, and or what's going on with your drinking, your woodworking, your friendship with Duncan. I'm kind of like there's this big headline where I'm like first and foremost, I'm just kind of in a holding pattern thing where you're like I'm in some kind of inert like I'm not putting any energy out. I'm not really taking any in. Like I'm some kind of like weird chrysalis that we don't know if the caterpillar's dead or not.
Oh my God.
Like, yeah. it could be the coolest thing in the world if something happens from here. Or is this just what happens when a caterpillar dies?
Wow. Wow.
I was reading something about this is like kind of a sad but also cute. I find it part of it uplifting. So I was explaining to somebody about we were talking about acetone and fingernail polish, and I was like, by the way, trivia about that thing with the caterpillar experiment where they used the chemical from fingernail polish to test whether or not caterpillars retained any memory at all through the metamorphosis before they become a moth or a butterfly. And the person I was talking to had never heard of that. I feel like your listeners probably, that's like, they're beyond that. They're like, yeah, don't even waste my time. They already started hitting the 15 second forward button. I mean, I'll try to take 15 seconds so you can hit the button, and I'll tell Duncan about the acetone thing. They took a bunch of caterpillars. They basically tased them with tiny caterpillar tasers while making them smell fingernail polish. I'm oversimplifying here. Also, wow. I'm making it more adorable because it was definitely more like they made them crawl across a plate that was fucking subtly electrocuting them. But in any case, they subjected, let's say, 100 caterpillars to mild electric shocks while making them smell fingernail polish, which is just a potent enough thing that they knew caterpillars could smell it.
Yeah.
So then they let all 100 of them then go on and make their chrysalises and hang out and turn into butterflies. Then they took the 100 butterflies and, you know, said, I'm sorry, I got to go back. I'm sorry. They only electrocuted 50 of them. They made them all smell nail polish. They tased 50 of them while doing that. They let all 100 of them turn into butterflies. Then they go, hey, butterflies, what do you think of nail polish remover? And 50 of those butterflies went, get the fuck away from me.
Wow.
That was, I'm being hyperbolic and silly.
So they remember.
Their finding was something, and And I remember thinking, like, you know, you could have asked any 9-year-old girl, like, you didn't have to do all of this, like, Guantanamo stuff. there's no life-loving, like, sentient little kid on Earth that couldn't have told you before you did that experiment. Well, of course the caterpillar is going to remember if you traumatized it before you went to sleep and woke up as a butterfly. But yeah. The scientists are like, I'll be damned.
Yeah.
I'll be damned. You can really get in these fuckers' heads. Anyway, the thing that I thought was adorable about it in a sad kind of tragic way is, like, because I was explaining this to someone that was going, I've never heard about this. I didn't want to be wrong about it. And I didn't know if I was going to be, like, misleading somebody about the science. So I Googled it. And when you Google caterpillar, you when you Google any question about caterpillars, like, the results you get clearly indicate that in spite of this being a new world with, like, speeding bullet trains and robots and aliens visiting us and AI taking over, one thing hasn't changed, which is that there are still kids out there everywhere collecting caterpillars, putting them in boxes. Because all of the results, when you Google, it's other kids asking, why did my caterpillar die? Why did I do something wrong, basically? I remember wanting to know that. Yeah. Like putting caterpillars in a cardboard box and feeding them leaves, and then they, one day you open the box and they're all dangling like gremlins, like, from their chrysalis, and then the big question that the kids want to know is, wait, how come they all didn't turn into butterflies? And the answer is, because God plays the numbers and you didn't do anything wrong. That caterpillar could have been an alcoholic way before it digested itself with its own shitty enzymes.
Because
the kids are thinking, like, I must have done something wrong. I must have misfed the caterpillar. I must have traumatized its chrysalis. To me that doesn't darken my world. I thought that was sweet, because I like the idea that today's children are still human, and they still anthropomorphize the nature around them, and they still want to, like, raise things and do it right, and they're still learning about life and death in similar ways.
Yeah, that's comforting, right? That because the you can get caught up in all that stuff you mentioned earlier and get the sense that, like, you know, okay, it's definitely some form of apocalypse. It's not the apocalypse we predicted. It's weirder than any apocalypse, and it's converging weirdness on weirdness on weirdness on weirdness, which is probably for a lot of people so intolerable that they just stop listening to it. But still, yeah, things are, this is something my David Nixon, my meditation teacher, said to me for years, which I've thought about over and over, which is the world today, people today, rather, are exactly the same, or pretty much the same as when the Buddha was walking around. Like, nothing has really changed that much at all. Exactly the same issues, exactly the same. You know, it makes sense just from a biological perspective. I'm guessing, like, the neocortex, probably, if it has changed over the last 1,000 years, it hasn't changed that much. It's probably pretty much the same, and meaning that, like, the root of it all is identical. And that's the confusing thing about all this stuff. Things have gotten faster. Things are shinier and brighter, but the computer running this stuff is just, it's the same damn computer. But I don't know. I'm afraid to Google if the neocortex has evolved, like how long it takes for a human brain to evolve over time. I don't know if there's been any changes.
Because, I mean, what you learn from the caterpillar experiment, to me, has huge implications on that, because what you happen to learn from that is that even though a caterpillar turns to complete soup before it becomes a butterfly, in other words, there ain't no caterpillar brain inside the chrysalis that, like,
yeah,
sits in there and then gets transferred into a butterfly chassis.
Yeah.
It's the head-to-toe caterpillar turns completely into what we would pretty much call the absence of a caterpillar, minus the fact that it's still, it doesn't have a heart, it doesn't have lungs, it doesn't have kidneys, it definitely doesn't have a brain. It's freaking soup. And it's like a homogenous operin's primordial soup that then genetically we get it. It's coded to then start the butterfly process. I think there's entomologists now who will maybe write in if that's still a thing and say, because I think it might retain a nervous system. It might not be complete soup, but
right.
But the scientists were interested to know, because to me what it suggests is, oh crap, your thumb, if you hit your thumb with a hammer, it might not matter if you got over it in therapy. Your thumb might actually pass on the experience of getting hit to your son's thumb.
Yeah.
I know that's a childish way of interpreting it, but it also is like it more coalesces with what our therapists tell us and what our Eastern like advisors have always told us, which is more in keeping with like full body health and stuff, saying like you are not a brain inside a Lego structure with two arms and two legs. It's like piloting it around. You are your fingernails, you are your heart, you are your kneecaps, your whole body experiences things, and that's a departure from the Darwinian model that suggests that there's this completely autistic, for lack of a better word, separation between genetic information. Like the only way your species can change is because a mutation that stands the test of two people hooking up, and just gets passed on accident, and then accidentally makes your kid get into college better than the other kid. Like that's the standing kind of mutation based Darwinian model. And we've always been poking holes in that mathematically. We're like, well, there's something a little more going on here, because you don't just get a gradually longer neck as a giraffe. Like one day they kind of grow a little longer, and humans, like we evolve in these spurts. Now, to add to that, this idea that, remember, my high school science teacher was very clear on the fact that he's like, you use the example and say like, okay, so Jessica here has curly hair. If I take a hairbrush and curl out her hair, if I give her straight hair, and then she has a baby with Mark over here, and we're all thinking at this point, what high school did you go to that the teacher's talking this way? And I'm like, it was called the late 80s, but the point he was making was like, their baby's hair isn't going to be straight because I combed out Jessica's hair. Right.
Right.
And that's something that we did need to learn in high school, but it's not something that we know for sure about life for sure yet, that these experiences that we're having in one lifetime, there might be a way that information is finding its way into our DNA. That sounds like pop science to anybody who's like a straight liner, but I mean, it's the idea that we're, you know, it's like if I take the right ayahuasca or the, you know, or just everything that I'm learning in my life, like, is it affecting like me in a way that changes the sperm cell that might impregnate Cody? Sometimes it's comforting what you were saying, that, well, look, everything's staying the same. We're our species is a minute old compared to anything like that's quote unquote beneath us. Like, yes, we're apex, awesome, leading edge, like the latest in biological innovation from an evolutionary standpoint, but that also makes us dumber in crucial ways. Like it makes us unable to know ourselves very well, because we don't have a big long history the way spiders do. We don't know nothing about ourselves except that we just got here, and so sometimes it's really comforting to be like, we haven't changed, we're still cavemen. Absolutely nothing has changed about that, because the healthy thing about that is to observe, like, look, I know your boss is yelling at you and you haven't had your coffee today and the guy cut you off on the freeway and then we're talking about AIs replacing your job. It's okay for you to be freaking the fuck out about that stuff and punching a wall or taking a shit, you know, passive aggressive way at a 7-Eleven, whatever your weird, whatever shit that you thought you were gonna, where you're like, what am I doing? I think it's comforting. We tell ourselves, it's like, what you're doing is losing your mind because you're a gorilla man and you like are, you're dressed up like a spaceman and like holding a briefcase and going like beep, beep, noop, noop. Like, and you're properly shaming yourself for not living up to the standards of a gray from planet Gababoop, but you really are just a blink of an eye ago, one of those australopithecines that was like, they were dry humping each other in the cold open of Kubrick's movie. But then again, sometimes that's really discomforting. Like to say you haven't changed that much. And you're saying right now, like, I haven't checked, but they'll release these studies where they're like people would have to Google this. I don't have actual information that I'm going to get right, but you'll hear something about like how human women are their puberty is coming earlier or later, as a result of changes or something, or the amount of artificial light is like changing when our species gets its first period or some shit like that, our sperm count being like way lower since World War II. So then there's those things where you're like, just when you're tempted to be like what your friend said, like, yeah, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So you have the same problems that they had in Buddha's time. And then you're like, yeah, but also shit. Like what about the fact that we're like surrounded by like, you know, shit that's affecting our environment? I don't know. There's people that say they insist on walking around barefoot, and I can't fault their logic because they stick a multimeter in, you know, one needle in the earth and they touch the other one with their finger and they go, look at the amount of charge that comes up through the ground into your body if you're walking around barefoot on the natural earth.
Yeah.
And that now look, when you're wearing shoes, you're disconnected. How is that not supposed to affect an animal that has now controlled? I don't know. That sounds like hogwash sometimes, but then it's like, damage can we do in like a short period of time within a couple generations if everyone's just like, we should start wearing shoes? And then all of a sudden it's like, little did they know, you're supposed to receive a 0.05 milliamp electrical current through the bottom of your feet like for 12 hours a day, or you start to lose your fucking mind.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, like saying, like, I don't think he means like, like, humanity. I mean, you can just look at like the size of humans through, like, you go to the you know, my mom used to be into this and it seemed so boring. Honestly, it still does to me. They do these, the thing where you go to like London and you take a piece of paper and put it over some of these, I don't know, coffins and you scrape them. So you get like, you know, the image of the coffin. Anyway, people were very short back then. Like we've gotten
babies,
much.
Little baby people.
Tiny little kings. You picture kings as being like hulking. They were little people. Like if we travel back in time, we would seem like giants. And I'm sure, you know, there's infinite other things that we don't even know about that used to be part of being human that are just gone now, that, you know, pre-flood shit, who knows? But the component that is staying the same is old age, disease, and death. That these things that we have to contend with, those don't seem to be going away. And then the other thing that isn't changing is that all of this shit is happening inside of space. That there is some, like, well, in Buddhism they call it emptiness. So there is this a quality of sort of non. Even the word itself is confusing, but, and you know, to get into the science of it all, you know, all of us by now have heard that within our atoms there's space. There's more space that we don't see it, but that we're just space.
Like, remember in high school they would show a football field and then say like if this football field were an atom, like the quarterback would be an electron or a proton or something like that. That's the ratio of nothing to stuff an atom is. It's always.
And you're not, your ass never touches a chair. Have you heard this one?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just being,
you're
repelled,
just essentially
by...
repelled. You know, we don't even touch anything. We're just being repelled by everything.
Nothing's ever touched anything. Right. I mean,
nothing's ever touched anything. And so all of this points to, what is, I think, really uncomfortable for a lot of people, which is that you are mostly empty inside, mostly emptiness. There's more space than there is matter in the universe, and that the human experience is one of existing within that absurd reality in the most temporary, fleeting way, like a game show where you are supposed to learn some complex shit in like 5 seconds and then you're gone. That seems to be the same. Like that, like regardless of how much cum we're splattering out on our
and when you get your period and what was, and how much shorter Napoleon was than Al Capone.
Yeah. Yeah. Still just no matter what, still in that predicament of 3, 4, 5 generations after we're dead, no one is going to be really like talking about us. Maybe you, but I'd say you get like seven generations, you know?
I like that you're trying to be conciliatory. You're like, I don't want to look, like I can't tell if you're wanting to keep me from going out on a ledge because I want to be remembered 5 generations from now, or if you're like being like,
I think I'm being
another
realistic
interpretation of me, that you're being self-loathing where you're like, well, maybe you, but not me.
I want to be remembered. It'd be fun. Yeah, no, it's a little bit of everything you mentioned. I didn't make Community. Like that people are, that's going to be floating around for a while. There's an echo of Harmon that will probably be a little less entropic than the Trussell echo. People will still read that bullshit book of poetry you wrote about how awful Gaddafi is. That'll be floating around. Someone will uncover that.
I will defend that the same way I always have. It was supposed to be a book about dogs. That's what I sold to Penguin House.
Yeah, but you didn't.
I told him halfway through, I had a lunch with my editor, and he said, a lot of these dog poems are becoming about Gaddafi and your hatred for him. And I was like, I'm trying, Brian, I'm trying. And Brian said, you're misinterpreting me, Dan. And then he turned to the waitress and said, who we still called waitresses, and he said, can I have more NutraSweet, which we were putting on everything back then.
Everything.
And I believe I probably, if I was having a typical day, I was probably like, and two Rubik's cubes, please. And then he turned to me and said, you're misinterpreting me, Dan. I'm telling you, drop the dogs, go Gaddafi. Like, and I was like, really? And he's like, I know that we told you we didn't want an anti-Gaddafi book when we, but I can see you straining within the fabric of this dog bullshit. Like, I get that you love basset hounds, but I get more that you hate Gaddafi. And the truth is, I can't contain it. And I don't want to be that guy.
But you were ripping off Shel Silverstein. I mean, to me, it's you want to do a fucking angry book about Gaddafi, go ahead. But don't do Shel Silverstein. Gaddafi, get off of me. That's...
Well, it was awful. I mean, the book gets sold by what's on the cover, okay? So you're literally judging a book by its cover. Yes, it was me shrugging, like, it's wordplay, but...
It was awful. The picture is awful. I'm sorry, man. I would not say this to someone I didn't love. Gaddafi, get off of me. If I was your editor, I would have killed myself. I would hate myself.
I regret it.
Wait, no. I'm sorry if this is like too much information and a secret. What did happen to that editor? Can you talk about what happened to him?
Well, his son killed him. His kid got shot by his own son. And it was for bad editing. But the technical truth is that his son did not serve a day of time because the jury and judge agreed that it was, according to them, what do they call it? Lawful homicide? What do they call it? Like justifiable homicide.
It was justified. Yeah, it's the most insane case. Justifiable homicide. Well,
because it was open season on editors. They said it was going to be, but then the other side of it was like, no, this was the worst editor ever. The bottom line is a man died, and apparently legally, and I think that's insane. Was he a good editor? Not according to our government.
Your book was the last book he edited.
Yeah, it was me, and I think he did one by Dershowitz.
Yeah, the Dershowitz was okay, but goddamn, Gaddafi, get off of me.
Yeah, did the guy deserve to get murdered? I think we're all gonna all agree. I'm not gonna write another book.
Libya Schmibia.
Okay,
like, that's not even a poem.
Did read it at least. You got past
yeah,
the cover.
Yeah, I read it. You're my friend.
You got past
read
the
your
cover.
Book.
That's good. Libya Schmibia. Actually, Libya I like Schmibia? That one, but whatever.
How do you even edit that? How do you edit that, Libya Schmibia? No.
The point wasn't to edit it. The point was to express myself. Maybe you edit too much.
Libya Schmibia, go. Time to go, Gaddafi. Time to go.
Yeah.
That's not even a poem. I don't even know what that is.
Well, that's one stanza. Libya Schmibia, go. Do you have your coat? Do you have your hat? I don't know. Libya Schmibia, come. Where have you been? To Texas and some.
Yeah. It's so bad.
I can't.
Such a great writer.
I was fucking
high,
all right? I was high. Like, it wasn't, I shouldn't even have been rhyming. Frankly, that's the thing I regret. Of course the rhymes were forced. I should have had the guts to just say, Gaddafi's a bad guy.
Yeah. I gotta tell you, man, it's so sappy. I feel so lucky to be on your show. Like, it is the coolest fucking thing, the coolest experience to watch the evolution from the table read to, like, and knowing you well enough to know where you've been involved, like, watching the shift. It's the coolest thing. And it's also the coolest thing to just be an actor. Mm-hmm. You just get to come in. Read the lines.
Yeah. But, well, I know. Yeah, that must be pretty fun.
It's the best. best. It's, you know, I haven't made a billion shows. I made one show, and I love the fact that I got to make it. But my God, those are some of the most stressful. That was like the most stressful year of my life. Like the number of plates you have to keep spinning, the pressure, the stress, not knowing, trying to interpret what the executives are saying, trying to not overinterpret it or not let it like impact too much, learning how to like convey what you're planning to do to them. The whole plethora of weird skills that you have to be able to do that stuff. How are you handling it? How are you handling doing that on top of all the other things that you're doing? I'm sorry if you get asked this question all the time, but when people mention you, generally, it's kind of like, how the fuck is he doing all of this simultaneously? How are you doing?
I don't think, you know, I'm doing fine. I don't like my relationship with my work. I there's a version of me that used to obsess about what I did, and that guy wasn't a great guy. He wasn't happy. He wasn't making other people happy, except through his work sometimes, possibly. But I don't think the ratio of misery experienced to pleasure out was, I don't think it was equitable, but I know that that guy would look at the guy I am now and be like, what are you even doing? Like, you suck. And I'd be like, well, of course you'd say that because now I'm happy. But they're both right. I don't think it's possible to make something that like changes a person from sad to happy if you yourself didn't undergo a kind of almost equivalent thermodynamic shift while you were making it. I think if you're just hanging out and being like, let's all have fun and get home by five, I think you're gonna end up with something that kind of at best people can lean on with an elbow and like they won't fall over, maybe. It's really, really, really difficult. I mean, it's just like the chorus of voices and the way they contradict each other in my head. Like I can't tell whether what I do is good or bad anymore, partially because the thing I had to rewire in my head in order to achieve a decent life is I had to open up that panel where there was a wire connected to, or let's say where every wire that connected to what I do for a living was connected to my self-worth and all these things, and I had to like rearrange those wires. They had to be like, some of them had to go, some of them had to like be inverted, some had to be like take a detour through. Well, yeah, but if you're home at 3 a.m. instead of 5 p.m. you still, it's such a fucking like, what the one of the many ways in which the old version of me had an advantage is that you wouldn't need this long of an answer to are you happy with your work from that guy, because he would either say yes or no, and he could throw in as a bonus piece of information, therefore I'm either a good or a bad person, and he'd be done with the answer. And here I am with my Gandalf beard and my low blood sugar diet and my harm reductive drinking and my my eye statements and my beautiful dogs and my prioritization and my cognitive behavioral priorities and things. I'm just like, but ask me if I like the thing I made yesterday. I don't fucking know. For all I know, it could be better. There are moments when I go, if I accidentally see something I made 10 years ago, I'll go like, ooh, that wasn't as good as I remembered it.
You know what? Not that it matters. And I don't know how you do that. You untangle yourself from your work. God, Jesus, that I know what you're talking about, and it's so fucked up. It's so fucked up that one's happiness or one's sense of value as a human being is connected to some, whatever the output is. I mean, it's like hardcore capitalism, hardcore. It's exactly what like would work. And it's why there's an Adderall shortage. It's, you know, we've been taught to do that. It's satanic. It's satanic. And I wish I could say that I didn't do that.
And there's a mental health crisis and too much artist worship because it's way more likely that you're going to make something good in collaboration with a bunch of people. Even in the old days when we could get away with, you know, the auteur model, where we would say, well, this guy's a genius, so everything he makes, oh, Christopher Nolan by himself, well, the rest of us can only let him down if we work with him. When we could get away with that, it was still very true and very obvious that, yeah, but Christopher Nolan's going to need the right 200 people helping him.
Yeah.
Or this could go one way or the other. But now we know even that's not, you don't even start that but we've got so much momentum, that comes from, like you say, it's like this, it's this hustle culture that it's capitalism, that capitalism never asked for the job, the very low paying job of raising children. It would have said, no, I'd rather work on Wall Street, but we gave it every fucking job in the country, and capitalism will take any job you offer it. Like, it won't just leave one laying on the sidewalk. Like capitalism would turn a profit off of homelessness if it could. It will.
Yep.
And so, yes, when we decided, you know, both parents should go to work, and they should instill their children through their nanny with the values that will get that kid into the college, that gets that kid placed in a job that will allow them to have enough children that can work. All of that is part of an explosion of our economy. Now, so like, the where that trickles all the way down to me is I go, oh yeah, so for a while there I was really fucking proud of myself for being supposedly the guy whose job it was to determine whether or not millions of people felt good when they watched TV. And my big dilemma is like, I'm like, you know, if I could live my life all over again, I know that there is a way to actually be an incredibly gifted producer of television. Unfortunately, it very much involves being good with people and because there is such a job as like being a leader, but it doesn't involve soloing on your guitar and expecting everyone to catch up to you, and it doesn't involve throwing your guitar at anyone, and it doesn't involve even inspiring them to be better at guitar. It involves fucking like it just involves like listening to them and like working I sound like I'm being like mock humble almost, like it's not, and I'm not that woke that I'm like dull bullshit. I just think there needs to be somebody at the top of a thing, but that person's job is just as much to like you get to get up at 6 a.m. and be like excited to give and take notes. You can't get up at 6 a.m. You can't still be awake at 6 a.m. and be like, and I better not get any notes on this because I spent a long time on it. Is that guy going to get better work done? Yeah. But the person's going to go insane and like, I don't know. They're going to burn out.
Right.
Like you said, it's like capitalism will burn you out if you give it the complete job of like what you should be doing when you should be doing it. So what am I going through? I'm 50 years old. I'm like, if you legalize heroin tomorrow, you're not going to have a bunch of happy people that handle heroin responsibly. And if Dan Harmon refuses to work past 5 tomorrow, you're not going to, I don't think you're going to get a bunch of good TV. Right away. I don't think and maybe I, and that's what I'm going through is kind of like, ugh, is there any way to keep the quality, but have people not go home from working with me going like, why has he gotta make me feel so empty?
Right.
Like, no, I don't, not for me, not in this lifetime. So I think I'm kind of like,
fuck.
I'm just sort of like, I'm like, can you guys get your shit together and like make something good? Like without me, please. Cause I gotta quit. I gotta stop doing this. Cause look at my hair. Look at my face. Look at my eyes. Do I look like a guy who wants to die on set like Robert Altman? I'm not that kind of guy. Right. I don't have that kind of passion. My passion was for getting people to not kill me. And I knew I wasn't going to accomplish that by being a welder. I would have been a,
right.
I found a thing that made people stop looking at me like they were about to eat me for dinner, which is, yeah, you know, typing stories. And then I kept at that. And then got to a point where I could create jobs, then started having to deal with this idea that I had never been the underdog and was now actually, you know, responsible for people being unhappy, and then going like, fuck, that means, yeah, they're going to eat me. That was the whole point, was for that to not
fuck.
Happen.
Fuck. Right.
And then just going like, okay, now I'm going to make them. Okay. So now cool it, be a better person, be a good person. And then it's like, okay, let's get back to work. Oh, this sucks. Well, yeah, I'm trying to be a good person. Well, that's weird. Cause I still, right, hate working with you. I know. Don't add to it. But you only hate working with me till 5 PM. Right? No, I had to stay up till 3 AM. Well, that's on you. I gave, right, all my notes as of 5. I don't know where I'm at, man. I'm like, here's the other thing. The other thing that's so confusing about it is like you, if you're the luckiest person in all of capitalism, you the best case scenario, especially if you start from broke, let's say, not from inheritance, if you're the luckiest person in all of capitalism, you get to be completely unrelatable. You get to have problems that other people don't have. That's what you want. That is you winning, wow, Monopoly. You are the, wow, one who has a different set of problems than other people. Fuck. Otherwise, you're losing, right, at Monopoly, because everybody, right, doesn't have $200 when they pass go. You're the guy who does, and you're still playing because of it. So if that's the best case scenario, great. That's fine. That's nothing to complain about. And therein lies the extra paradox, because boy, am I used to complaining. And boy, that was one of my favorite things to do outside of working. I loved the balance of the two. That was my hobby. I did that for free.
Right.
I bitched and moaned about how unfair the world was to me. It was like my favorite thing. And you not only can you not do that anymore, if you get your wishes granted.
Yeah.
Now listen to me complain about that. And now I can finish your sentence for you. You can't complain about that either. You're complaining about not being able to complain. And I'm like, I know, I've been through this. It is an infinity mirror of I am alone. Wow. I got it. And I know I can't complain. I know that. Most people, when they say I can't complain, are expressing stability. There are some professional complainers out there, not professional, complaining enthusiasts, gourmand complainers. Like, I've been complaining
top
so
tier
long, and now I can't do it. Oh, poor baby. The best I can do is hate myself. That's all I can do is complain about me. But I can't do it to Cody. I can't do it.
Right.
I'm going to do it. I'm doing it here. And the best case scenario is people in the comments will be like, this guy is fucking gone, man.
No, they won't. They'll be like,
is he okay? And all this kind of stuff where that you express about people where you're like, oh, he's alone. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I wanted it that way. But like, you will miss in the best case scenario, kids, you will miss one day having enough misfortune that you at the very least felt like you were part of something. And I know that's Molly Ringwald in The Breakfast Club doing the monologue about how hard it is to be popular, but that's not, and it's hard to unbraid that stuff because it's like, by the way, popularity is not being alone. There's stuff you're not allowed to complain about.
God damn.
You can't complain about being pretty.
Perfect.
But holy, I bet shit, pretty people have a lot to complain about but if they do, there's a thing in your head that's going to be like, how about I punch your dumb face and solve all your pretty problems? You know, we all feel...
Well, you know, okay, here's one reason to complain, regardless of social standing, income, is because the complaint confirms your existence as a solid thing. The complaint is the thing that gives you a sense of identity.
Right.
Like, once that's gone, what the fuck are you? What do you have anymore if you don't even have your complaints? And because that's like, this is, you know, it gets written about in so many different ways. My favorite being, suffering is like standing on a floor of razor blades, just pain. And in this very sad attempt to evade the reality of suffering, you invent this story about why the suffering. The story gives you all kinds of control or a sense of control over it. And so this gets compared to like imagining a beam over the razors and then burrowing into that beam via your delusion, whatever the story is you're saying regarding the suffering, and then imagining that you're not on the razors anymore. And that's the complaint idea. The complaint is the bait. You think the complaining is going to mitigate or whatever. Mostly it just gives you a sense of identity. Well, there's a me. If there's complaining, right, there's a me, there's a self. And all this stuff you're talking about, the new way of working with people, the non-hierarchical or less hierarchical Stanley Kubrick model where he like famously tortures Shelley Duvall and it's a nightmare to work with him and everyone goes insane. But you get to work with Kubrick. It's just sick, but that he's lauded for that. That's like in our culture. That's like, yeah, he was a monster. He knew how to get what he wanted via pain,
yeah,
or whatever it is. You're talking about diffusion of identity into the whole via working with people, the collaboration, no longer, you don't get to be that, like, you're trying not to be that thing. And that could be very difficult, man. That's very intense.
Yeah, I think that's a great way you brought it back home, because we can let's use Kubrick, who is too dead to feel guilty about, like, using as an example, just use him as a metaphor. So was there a version of Kubrick that could have gotten that performance out of Shelley Duvall? Of course we know, I don't want to say, of course, like we know things that we can't prove, but like there's gotta be a way to make her look like haggard and at the end of her rope. Like,
yeah,
there probably is a way, like, but do we want to sit around and wait for him to figure that out before the cast and crew of The Shining get to rap and make money off of their movie? Or that metaphor hit a dead end because it's like, wait, those people aren't making any money. But I just mean, like,
I know what you mean.
It's just that's when at 50, I'm kind of like, I'm not a patriot about the auteur model. I'm just a fucking product of it. Like
right.
I am. My brain is so used to, like, there's so many muscles that are like, this isn't hard work at all. This part over here, the part where you really give a huge flying shit about what you do to the point where it affects you emotionally when it's bad.
Yeah.
That doesn't strain my back Because I was raised in a different gravity system. So your definition of something that should hurt to lift, that's not my definition. But then all these other things are like, it's like, yeah, but why would you even, you look how much time you're wasting feeling sorry for yourself or in, you know, and so you're tempted to think it's gotta be either or, and that's never the answer. It's just like, it's not either or, it's just a question of like, look, you were raised in a certain kind of environment and you did the best you could and you're a product of it and you're also accountable and you should change the way that you do things and map yourself and your universe's map should change as new data comes in. And I would never be one of those guys that's like, that's not true. We should keep doing it the old way because we were doing such great things and there was no other way to do them. I'll never be that guy, nor will I ever be the guy that's like, if everybody did it the new way, everything's going to be great again.
Right.
But all of those people are out of their goddamn minds because the truth is, it's like, it is undramatic, unrewarding, like it's not thrilling, the story of changing. It's not
right.
It's not an epiphany and then Jerry Maguire like comes in and he's a new sort of guy.
Right.
Now he's a better sports agent because he's the opposite of what a sports agent
yeah.
used to be. It's not that, and it's not greed is good from Michael Douglas, like, oh, thank God someone said the quiet part out loud that we should all be
right.
selfish. It is some really boring thing way in between that is really hard to accomplish, which is, dude, you have the psychological equivalent of like scoliosis and like you need to spend like hours a day like standing differently or being hooked up to certain equipment, and like if you do that like 20 years from now like your back might be like shaped the right way.
Dan, you're the fucking
your scoliosis like advocates are gonna write. I don't know. Dan Harmon doesn't know anything about scoliosis. I don't know what there might be people that are like, that was the most fucked up metaphor.
How could you say that?
Like,
have scoliosis, Dan.
Like, did you just tell me it's my fault that my back is like fucked up and that I haven't done enough work on it? No. Sorry. That was an unfortunate metaphor. Possibly. I don't know.
Dan, you're okay. Of all those butterflies who were caterpillars that were forced to get tased and crawl through acetone, I would imagine, and there might be a couple who are like, if you don't crawl through acetone, you will not turn into a butterfly. You have to get shocked, crawl through the acetone. That's how we do it from now on. We're crawling through. You want to be a butterfly like me? Look at these fucking markings. I didn't get that from just going into my fucking chrysalis in some kid's room.
Yeah.
No,
they're
shocked.
The butterflies you're describing are called road comics. Yeah, we know we're good friends with a lot of them.
You don't know what it's like. You don't know what it was like at Mark Gridley's Comedy Castle. You don't know what it was like. Man, I know we got to go. It's been over an hour. But Dan, I just must say this. And I know.
Wait, we used to talk for 3 hours. What are you talking about?
I will keep going. I don't want to hold you up, man, because I know. Well, I don't know how busy you are, but I just don't want to hold you up.
When do you think I'm happy?
Then we'll keep going. Because look, I do have to say this.
I didn't know you hit record
and again,
yet.
I'm on the show, obviously. So I have... You know, that means my nose is in it, but not as much as yours. And every time I go in there to do some new lines or whatever, it gets funnier and funnier. So I can tell you that, you know, again, being in it and having not seen any of it, any of the, or barely any of the cartoon itself, there's definitely a comedic evolution that's been happening every time. Like, it's getting funnier for sure. And I like to imagine that I have some sense of that, that isn't like nullified by, you know, being familiar with or being in a show. So I think you should feel good about it because it was already funny. It's just getting funnier and funnier.
Well, the cast is amazing. And I know this sounds really corny, but because it becomes such an umbrella that how can it have any value? How can it be true? A statement like everybody that's working on the show is doing a fantastic job. It's like, well, how is that true? And if it is true, how is it even important to say? But it's like the cast is incredible, and I think I'm just spoiled, and I want the show to be a classic on episode one, and it's not, and I'm like cranking that engine, and I'm like, so sometimes I go like, dude, you're being such a fucking like counterproductively entitled narcissist that you should be grateful that you've had two good shows instead of, and then go, so it takes a lot of luck and work to end up with a good show instead of
right.
This sort of like, why isn't this one good? It's like, you don't remember that you felt that way on, you know, season one of Rick and Morty. It's like, I can't let myself off of that hook because I'm also like, it just swirls and swirls, like the conversation I could have with myself. And it's just like, I want to talk about it with the planet, but and then it's like, the more I do, the more it just like, people just get that look on their face. Like, and I don't even know, it's like, some they might be thinking like, how, get over yourself, which would be a totally valid thing to say. Some of them might be thinking technically the opposite, but still basically the same thing, which is like, dude, stop complaining. You've made some great stuff. It's almost the same thing, but those two people would start fighting because they'd be like, no, he needs to get over himself. No, he needs to understand he's amazing and stop hating himself. I'm like, you guys, it's neither. It's like, I'm just telling you, it's fucking, you get a tennis ball can on your shoulders, and it's like, there's just gravel in it, and it just, you don't know what rattling is like supposed to be there, and what is your job? Open the lid and let the gravel out, like make the can silent, poke a hole, let the gravel breathe. Is it what I know is the sound my head makes when it uncontrollably shakes. I know, and I know that when I was 35, I could literally hook up a microphone and literally, this is amazing to think about, in my rocking chair with my shotgun and my glass of lemonade, I used to hook a microphone up and talk about this shit unfiltered to strangers and feel good about it. And reset myself and go, so that's how I feel. I was feeling a little alienated, a little separate from everybody. And then even without hearing people say, that's okay, we forgive you, we feel that way sometimes too, like having it like feel good, but then like I'm past that point where it's like, I can't do that anymore. I can't talk about what's going on in my head anymore. It's a crime. It's a fucking crime to share my thoughts with people.
No way. Come on. Really? Crime.
It's an abuse of privilege. It's a fucking
no.
There is no, and that's the best you can hope for. That's the end of the rainbow. You can get to a point where, congratulations, you can't talk to anyone anymore. Like you have nothing to do but either continue working quietly or retire. And boy, then they're really going to come after you.
You know, Dan, let me tell you something. There is something when I think it was on her first podcast that I think about in the same way I think about like stuff Ram Dass told me personally. And I carry it with me. I remember it in difficult times, which is you told me that if you are being yourself, your authentic self, telling the truth, and somebody doesn't like you, it's like they don't like a cloud. They don't like the weather. It's you. You're being you. Someone doesn't like you. It's like this is who you are. And so I think that from this conversation, what I've extrapolated, because I'm probably an idiot, is you have to start podcasting again. That's what you need to do. You need to start up Harmontown again. You do. You need to say all this shit out loud, exercise the demons, do the confession, go through the whatever the fuck it is. And who cares, by the way, if people are like, you motherfucker, how are you complaining about that? Or how could you be upset about that?
Well, that honestly, should be the one, man, get that. I mean, it's like, it shouldn't matter anymore. And it's not like I'm going to be a fucking controversial brand or something. It's just, my worst case scenario is if I do that again is unrelatability. Big deal. Like, yeah,
suffering is relatable.
You're right about that in every mathematical way that you could ever look at. I don't know that it needs to be a reboot of Harmontown, because there might be connotations there that you could betray, or you know, a brand or something. I mean look what I'm doing. I'm holding you hostage because I
love it. I don't want to leave. I thought I was holding you hostage.
I am better off in terms of mental health when I am talking about this stuff. And like, some people would say, well, that's what a therapist is for. You pay them and then you talk. And I'm like, yeah, but that's just 50 minutes. And also, like, even they'll fucking, you can see the glassy eyes after a while. They don't, it's like, so, yes, I do think you're correct about that. I need to have an outlet where I'm like talking, like, even if it's just like
say it out loud,
reading the weather, you know, I need like to do a thing,
yes,
a microphone, because I
you're so good at it.
Well, or just say like, the design of my head is such that if there's not a hole in the back of my throat where the pressure can escape, like it doesn't do anybody good. It just builds up behind my eyeballs. And I,
yeah, man. And this is like, I think the idea that like people are going to be like, oh, you're at the top of the, how could you go? I don't think, first of all, I think the assessment is, you know, I started, it's so funny that I couldn't finish the book, The 4-Hour Work Week. Have you read that book?
No.
That, I think it's Tim Ferriss. Well, there, you know, there is an idea in there that I think is quite brilliant, which is, who gives a fuck if you have all the stuff and zero free time? That this, you, what, it doesn't matter how much money you have, how much wealth you've accrued, if you are working so much that you literally have no freedom, that freedom is actually the value, that's the only value. And so he's got this idea in there, which I love, which is, find the place of minimum effort, maximum result in your life. That's what you are looking for. Not maximum effort, maximum result. Minimum effort, maximum result. That's the equation for anybody, for freedom or whatever. And recognize that it would be better for, so, like, that. I think I'm going to fuck up the joke. Bill Burr has some kind of joke about, like, you know, yeah, maybe there's some guy like sleeping on a mattress somewhere with like $20 in his bank account, $100 or whatever, completely free. He's completely free. There's that freedom that both of us had at some point. Absolute freedom. No responsibility, no kids, no employees, no, you got to make this fucking work for everybody. We worked ourselves into an interesting little trap that the more you do what you're doing, the deeper into the trap you go. And part of, and then of course, like within that, this culture of not emoting the reality that of that trap as though like you're going to be judged. It's like, no, I think it's good for people to fucking hear. I think it's a good thing for people to hear the truth experientially from people so that they understand all your grind culture shit. It's probably going to work. Actually, it might work. You're going to work yourself to the bone. You're going to not hang out with your kids. Man, I just so sad. Oh, I won't say it. I'll tell you offline. But the point is, like, you're going to cross whatever fuck. You're going to cross whatever finish line you think on the other side is where you're at. And guess what's going to happen? You're going to cross that finish line, just like you said. You're going to win aloneness. You're going to win an aching sense of guilt because you can't enjoy what you have. Loneliness because you can't articulate that you are not enjoying what you have. And that, to me, the hearing that experientially from people versus some Aesop's fable or some bullshit is important so that people reevaluate, you know, really literally like revalue your life, man. Like, I don't think you need to worry.
It's true. I mean, the very act of somebody having nothing to gain by talking to people and choosing to talk to them, that should be therapeutic to everyone to hear anyway, because that confirms something that we need to have confirmed medicinally, which is like you said, I like the way you put it, which is like when we don't have real life examples of it every day, we're having to trust some very suspicious sounding Aesop's fables. And they feel like propaganda to us. We're like, was this written by somebody that wants me to be okay being poor? And it's better to just be like, oh, this real human being who I'm jealous of because they, you know, own a company and they're using 4 free hours to even like I said, like when David Lynch would like read the weather into a microphone or whatever, it's just like that's really that alone is something that strangers need. You could be helping them just by going, yeah, I just want to confirm that happiness is more complicated than being on a yacht by yourself and not needing to talk to anybody. That's pretty close to prison, but with water around you. And so there's a reason why. And it's just like, cause somebody would get that implication. And it's like, why are you on Twitter, Mr. Famous Person? Like, I'm going to throw shit at you until you leave. And then if that person's like, well, I'm leaving Twitter cause you're mean to rich people. And it's the sickness continues. And it's like, should that person be sitting on Twitter and trying to convince people that they're normal? No, but they should be. No. They should be open source and going like, by the way, just want to let you know, I'm not dead yet, but I am that guy that you heard of that, like, I definitely don't have to go to work tomorrow. And, but here's how I'm feeling. Here's what I had for lunch.
Yeah.
I would find that incredibly valuable. If I had a connection to a person. So I'm just agreeing with you. I think it is a thing you're doing for yourself and for other people is babbling at them like into a tin cup. I think that's important. I've been putting it off for a long time, and I just, cause it's a complicated relationship with it, but like, I gotta figure out a new way to do it where I just have ownership over it and comfort and authenticity and just permission to be boring, permission to do it erratically. I don't like people getting addicted to a thing and then it becomes a job and then you're like, oh, now I can either stop doing it or keep doing it. There's that whole thing.
Yeah. Just, you know, I, with this one, I think you just start doing it. Like, you just do it and you upload it and you get, you know, remember the thrilling feeling of uploading your podcast and being worried about some bullshit you said and knowing it's going to fly back in your face, and how fucking fun that was to feel that anxiety, like to not know what's going to happen when you unleash it into the world and all the weird responses that you get. But it's just the, you know, these conversations in my life, I don't know what I would do without them. Like, I would wither up. Like, I get it though, man. I mean, I'm being a little bit of a hypocrite because there are things that I don't complain about now that I used to. There are things that I won't say that I used to, completely out of fear of sounding like I've like lost touch, or I've become inhuman, or something like that. And I think that's sad that I'm being cowardly in that way. And I want to work through it eventually. And like, you know, but what, like, you know, it is
I
true.
Like,
our
I don't
journey know
if is we have to give ourselves permission to be whinier babies.
Yeah, you got it. Listen,
who would have thought,
what do they
who would
say?
Have thought that gets to be our final battle?
Squeaky wheel gets the cum. You gotta squeak. It doesn't matter. I think it's like most encounters that I have with people online, you know, if they're assholes, aside from it being like mildly interesting, I just mute them anyway, you know? So it's like, I never hear from that again. I just mute it. And then just a general basic rule that a lot of people I know podcasts have, which is don't read the fucking comments. If you want to fuck your mind up, go read comments written by 80% bots, you know, 10% people who are just for like having a rotten day, you know, and then 10% of people who probably legitimately would be happy if your head exploded. But, you know, don't go in there.
Well, also there's people that love you, they might their relationship with you and the reason they love you, I could say, just from being a showrunner, it's like that was a big phenomenon. It was like, you know, this is you got inside this person's head with your show. They are deeply immersed in it, and like they're at a point when they could give two shits that it's your show and not theirs. Like, you,
right.
It's like this is the ultimate fan, and so yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah, I've been in don't read the comments for over a decade, but that would never be a thing. But it's also just like, you get the comments anyway. They make it. They make their way to you. It's not.
They get through. You'll get a well aimed arrow that lands right.
I think there's a weird sickness to like also just like a total like wall up. Like it depends on how much effort's going into it. I don't know. That's another thing to contend with. Which is it's been easier to not do anything. Because if you do something, you have to then ask yourself, like, what is my policy about that? Am I, you know, because it's not quite as simple to me as like going, well, I don't read anything. Not if that becomes such an obstinate thing that it becomes sure. Almost performative in and of itself. Like,
no, I go like, in there sometimes.
Like if I'm reading less about myself than I'm reading about fucking Elon because he's in my newsfeed because I Googled him once, I'm like, I don't know how much healthier that is. I'm like, why is he in my fucking phone more
Everyone's
than I am?
Feed.
I should be in this fucking
Everyone.
Thing. Anyways, but all I did was extend our therapy session because I'm selfish, but
No, now I'm selfish. Now I have a mission. I want you to start podcasting again purely out from selfish. I fucking loved when I was on Harmontown. I think that there is an aspect to you that is performative. You're a performer. You are performing on that show. It sounds to me like you did the thing a lot of us performers did during the pandemic. I sure as fuck did. I didn't perform. I stopped performing for the whole goddamn pandemic. I'm not going out there and performing. I'm not going to get whatever COVID or what. I don't want people to come in to my shows and die 2 weeks later, kill somebody, all this stuff, no performing. And then I came to Austin and performed again. And that's when I got COVID. but I will say this, that first moment of like being back on stage, when I had, you know, been telling Aaron, maybe I won't do stand-up anymore. Maybe I'll just let the pandemic be the transition and I'll just be a podcaster. And that first moment of being in front of people again and performing, man, that was like, oh shit, I need this. Like, this is, without this, I'm like, I'm missing something in my life. And I think maybe that's the thing you're talking about. You're not a dead caterpillar. This isn't a dead caterpillar situation. This is just a performer who got fucked by the pandemic and is doing a show where, you're making awesome, funny things, but you're not getting a direct response from an audience to tune the guitar, so to speak. You know, to like get, don't you remember like that thing that happens when you're performing where the comedy part of your brain gets a little more fine-tuned or something? Something about direct reaction from an audience regarding funny, not funny, informs this part of your brain, and you carry that into your other work.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think now I'm starting to get into electronics. Like, so that's the metaphor that lends itself, where it's like, I think it's about voltage and resistance and amperage. I think that if your circuit's too simple, there's a fine line between a simple circuit and a short circuit. You know, the more complex it is, the less likely it is that there's going to be a feedback loop that creates technically infinite wattage, which is actually unhealthy, where the battery is getting back way too much of what it put out. And then it's overheating. It's like every human
right.
is different.
I gotcha.
We all need different levels and configurations of little light bulbs and resistors and diodes out there if all they do is like take the energy from in the battery and displace it enough that what is coming back to the negative end of our battery isn't overloaded with all of our own bullshit. It's another way of saying, it's a healthier way of saying that if you're an incomplete person, why not go wipe your fucking anxieties all over the faces of a bunch of strangers? It's kind of like better than dealing with it in your own head. But that's a mean way of saying it. And no, you're going to go insane if you keep letting this shit bounce around in your own skull instead of connecting with other people and sharing it with them. That's a nice way of saying it. But there's an objective truth, which is like there's an urge to do it. And the results of it are, by my memory, more positive than negative.
Like, right now they are for me. Hearing you talk about this stuff, you know, finding the places in me where I'm experiencing that, like, it's so good. It like helps people. And I, you know, I don't think that should be necessarily the reason you do it. And I think, you know, it is true. You are wiping your insecurities on people's faces, but people like that. There's actually a lot of pleasure in hearing that you're not the only fucking person suffering post-pandemic, that you're not the only person who's like going through shit and you're afraid to say it out loud. Satan, that's what the devil wants. That's Satan's like, shut the fuck up. You really gonna say that? You think you have anything to say anymore to people? Nobody wants to hear that shit from your ivory tower. Nobody wants it. Bullshit. That's total bullshit. That is not true at all. Not true at all. Suffering is universal. So the flavors of suffering or the configurations of the suffering ice cube in the suffering ice cube tray might vary, but the thing itself is universal, and the ability to like just freely talk about it is cathartic for everyone involved.
For once we agree on something.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's so, and you know, I'll tell you this, man, you know what happened to Gaddafi right before he got murdered in the most brutal way possible?
Well, I'll tell you what was about to happen. Uncle Sam was about to bomb him into the Stone Age.
You would have loved that. You hated that America didn't take him out. You loved it was some CIA. You hated it with the CIA. Let the Libyans do it. You fucking hated that. You hated that. CIA, not today. Another shitty poem in your book. CIA, not today. You took the glory of bombing Gaddafi.
I feel so bad for the listeners that think if I just Google Gaddafi, I'll find all of this very funny. Like, and it's like, no, not really. Like, there's nothing in the Gaddafi Google entry that's gonna make you go, oh, what a great bit.
Listen.
It's just absurdism. It was just absurdism. It was a random reference, and then we doubled down.
Dan, if you want to start an anti-Gaddafi, or like a sort of like, remember that dumb show where they had the liberal and the conservative and they would argue with each other over, I will do that with you with Gaddafi. I will be the person who defends Gaddafi. You hate Gaddafi. We can fight, find a common ground around Libya, Gaddafi, what happened, the petrodollar. And I think it will be a very beloved podcast. Dan, I love you so much, man. It's so nice to catch up with you. I miss you a lot. Always,
yeah, I miss you too. It's always life redeeming. Wait, Cody's at, I was like, I gotta do Duncan's podcast, and she's like, oh, well, tell him we gotta do a double date. I'm like, he doesn't live here. I'm right? I'm not just yelling at people.
Yeah, Cody's right, and but if I think you would really.
You don't live
yes,
here.
Yes, sorry. I'm sorry I said Cody's right. I know you hate it when I say that. You're right.
You know what I call her? You know how wrong she is? I call her Cody Gaddafi. That's how wrong she is.
Wait, let me ask you this. This might be an offline question for real. Are you guys kicking around reproducing? Did I hear that? Like, kicking around?
I haven't all the way. We haven't shut the door on it. You know.
Okay, offline. Get ready for never-ending, horrific breeder pressure.
I'm not talking to you offline. I'm going from here to the bar.
I miss drinking with you, Dan.
I'm going from here to the bar to tell everybody all the stuff you told me in confidence about aliens.
And that will be edited out. Marking clip. All right, Dan. I love you, man. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, my baby. Yeah, I miss it. I love you, too. I can't wait to see you again.
That was Dan Harmon. Everybody, a big thank you to our sponsors. Remember, you're going to get banged down and bulked up this summer by me. All the links you need to find the application to apply to be one of my clients are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. And, of course, there is an initiation fee, and I just don't want to hear it from folks like, my God, I can't afford $50,000 just to fill out a form. I don't want to sign all these NDAs. Okay, fine. Go work out by yourself. Go find another trainer. Go try to emulate my process. It's not going to work. How much is your health worth to you? I've got to ask for those of you who don't want to pay that initiation fee. It's just your body. It's just the thing that carries you around through the world. It's not worth much, I guess, to you. But for those of you who really want to get in shape, love life, and are good people, I know you'll be willing to pay the tiered fee system. And of course, you will get commissions for clients that you bring to me as you rise up in the multi-level marketing structure based on the Enneagram that is built into my new corporation. So I look forward to hearing from all of you business-minded, health-minded, sexual entrepreneurs out there. We are going to have a great summer. I'll see you next week.